Hi, I'm Dave Kelch.
And I'm Warwick Johnson. Welcome to Cinemastalgia,
where we rewatch movies from our childhood and see if they really are great, or if time has passed them by.
It's time to get nostalgic with your old pals Dave and Warwick. From Independence Day to Platoon, Cinemastalgia's starting soon. Yes, Cinemastalgia's starting soon. Have some fun with them, they're watching movies. From stuff that makes you laugh to stuff that's spooky. You want to listen? Well, don't have a cow, cause Cinemastalgia's starting now. Yes, Cinemastalgia's starting now. Now Dave and Warwick, come on out, take a bow, cause Cinemastalgia's now.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to episode 2 of Cinemastalgia with your host, Dave Kelch.
And Warwick Johnson.
Yeah. So, this episode's movie is going to be Demolition Man, The Mystery of the Three Seashells. This movie was released in 1993, directed by Marco Brambilla, and it stars Rocky, Sylvester Stallone, Blade, Wesley Snipes, and the bus drivers from Speed, Sandra Bullock.
That's right.
Also along with Dennis fucking Leary.
The cast alone for this movie is absolutely bonkers, and that's what makes it so good. The fact that Rob Schneider is in the same film as Nigel Hawthorne just blows my mind.
Right. And then you've got Benjamin Bratt from the Law & Order franchise.
At a time when Benjamin Bratt was more famous than Sandra Bullock.
So now, Warwick, you chose this movie for this week.
Yes,
I did.
It's funny because when I was growing up, we had a VHS player, which is, of course, what like everybody had back in the day. But we didn't have very many VHSs. But one of the films that we owned was Demolition Man. And so we had it on VHS, and we watched this movie all the time. I loved this movie as like a kid. So it came out in 93, so I was still like 8, 9. Which is great. I mean, like, you know, it's not like there's language in it, sure, but it's not like insanely gory violent. And like there's one brief nudity.
Yeah.
So it was like a movie that my mom was like, yeah, this is fine. You can watch this. That's not a problem.
My background with this movie is I would have been 14, 13, 14, depending on when in the year it was released. Yeah, I remember actually pretty sure I saw this movie in theaters, and being the like sci-fi buff that I am, I just remember enjoying it, and its vision of the future is so interesting.
Yeah, I think that's interesting is a good way to put it. It's completely fucking insane is the other way that I would put it.
Getting into the movie itself. So when it starts, we are set in 1996. So only, like, I think it was filmed, like we said, filmed in 92. So it's only 4 years beyond the present day. And I remember 1992. I mean, I didn't live in Los Angeles, and I do know that the crime in L.A. in the 90s was a huge problem. I mean,
early 90s especially,
yeah.
And I mean, also around the time there's the riots and stuff, too, was a big deal in Los Angeles. Not in 92, but a little bit before. To start the scene off, the Hollywood sign is just in flames. And they're flying this helicopter into the part of the town that Simon Phoenix, Wesley Snipes' character, has taken over. And him and his gang run it. And they kill people that go into that territory.
He kidnaps
a bus.
Yeah.
Yeah. A city bus goes into the part of town that Simon Phoenix controls. So he hijacks it and he takes all of the passengers hostage. And that's what draws Sylvester Stallone, the Demolition Man.
Yes. John Spartan.
One of the best action movie names, I think.
Well, and it's funny since, you know, we just rewatched it recently. Ooh, it's kind of like, isn't Master Chief in Halo? His name is John. And he is also a Spartan. And I'm like, are the guys from Bungie 343, you know, I mean, originally Bungie. Halo. I mean, were they Demolition Man fans?
And
they're like, we're
going
to call these people Spartans. And the Master Chief, the main character, we're going to call him John. He's John Spartan.
John Spartan.
He's a genetic ancestor of the Master Chief.
Yeah. So, yeah. Nice.
We open, and Spartan is heading into this section of town to go rescue the hostages.
A helicopter that's piloted by Die Hard's Special Agent Johnson. So once again, flying a helicopter.
I would want to ask him, if I ever met him, do you actually know how to fly a helicopter? Because you were typecast in these roles for some reason. So anyway, so they go in and there's like, it's a hot LZ, as I believe they would say.
It's a firefight. John Spartan is basically bungee jumping into this like abandoned warehouse that has like all these loose fires going on. And there's dudes shooting at him with automatic weapons. John Spartan has a handgun.
Yeah.
And he kills like four or five guys with automatic weapons on this rooftop. That's crazy. Like, how bad at shooting are people in this film? Because it's really, they're like, if you drank every time somebody missed a missed who they're shooting at, you would just be completely drunk.
So yeah, so I mean, then we get to the point where he makes his way through the building, confronts Simon Phoenix, and I believe this is the point at which where he's doused everything in
gasoline.
And basically goads Spartan into attacking him. And Spartan gets the upper hand, captures him, but the gasoline does get ignited and all the other explosives. So basically the building goes up in flames.
Yep.
Everything explodes, but he, Sylvester Stallone, gets out of the building with Simon Phoenix in tow and has captured him. So then comes perhaps one of my honestly favorite parts of the movie, because it creates a great headcanon for me that Demolition Man and Lethal Weapon exist in the same universe. I'm not sure what the character's name is in Demolition Man.
I don't even know if he ever gets a name.
Yeah. I mean, he maybe have a name in the credits or something, but no one refers to him by name on screen. Mm-hmm. So I prefer to believe that the guy who shows up, it is the police captain from Lethal Weapon. Like, all of the Lethal Weapon movies. His name is, I believe, Steve Cahan. And he's, you know, that's like his thing, is playing a grizzled police captain who has to deal with officers and detectives who do all this shit he just does not approve of and causes problems for him. And he just starts chewing out Spartan because you're like, your assault was unauthorized and all this. But what I love to believe is that these two movies exist in the same universe. And this guy has just had the worst career. Because first he had to deal with Riggs and Murtaugh, and now he's got to deal with John Spartan.
Yeah. And it means like an alternate reality where something happens to Riggs and Murtaugh. They're not around to keep law, like to keep law and order. And so this is what happens, Chief, when you don't let them go out and get results. He's basically playing the exact same role here. And it's just like, well, what about the hostages? And Stallone's like, oh, they're not here. You know, he must have stashed them someplace else. And then all of a sudden, some guy shows up and he's just like, oh, there's bodies everywhere. And it's just like, what? Like, so a different part of the building that, again, John Spartan blew up apparently was where the hostages were.
Yep.
So.
And so, yeah, he gets charged with like 38 counts of manslaughter.
Yeah.
And consecutive sentencing. And at his, the trial, and also this is another thing, because it's like, you know, 1996, only 3 to 4 years after filming / release, and they have like changed over the justice system in California completely to a like cryogenic prison system.
That's what they do with their worst offenders now, is that they freeze them. And then you find out later that while they're frozen, they're rehabilitated. They have, you know, programming that gets pumped into their brains while they sleep, and it's supposed to, you know, rehabilitate them. That's all well and good. However, I have to point this out. When you lock someone up in a regular prison, time passes and they get older, and then they learn the error of their ways or whatever. But then when they get released from like a 30-year sentence for killing someone, they are old men. You know, they're less likely to do things because they're not like young and impetuous or whatever.
Right.
With a cryo penitentiary, you are freezing someone that's like a 20-year-old kid that like robbed and murdered somebody. And then when he wakes up after 30 years for committing murder, he's still a 20-year-old kid that still has the capability to go out and murder people. Like, it's not, you're not releasing, you know, this is like if you were to release like Red or Brooks from Shawshank Redemption, but they're like, you know, 20-year-old selves that still are completely physically capable, you know?
Well, and I mean, a lot of times these criminals that will go into the system are in like peak physical condition, or they're like really dangerous, violent, physically uncontrollable people.
Simon Phoenix is like, because he's Wesley Snipes, so he's like the super, you know, martial arts like ripped dude. And you freeze him and then you unthaw him later. He's still a super ripped dude. Like, it's like, you know, time. He hasn't gotten all soft and doughy in prison. Like, now he's still like, now he's ripped and he's ready to like karate chop people to death. Yeah. It's like, this is the flaw in the system.
Right. So anyway, Spartan gets sentenced to,
it's a long time. It's like 40 years. It's no, because only 40 years has passed and Spartan's not up for parole. So I think he's sentenced for like 60 years in the cryo penitentiary.
And so that's like the sequence that we get where, you know, of course he's naked, you know, and they fill the they essentially turn them into like hockey pucks.
They're hockey puck shaped.
Yeah.
I guess to easily transport them, you can just slide them.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like he gets in and they pour this like liquid gel thing into the like container that he's in and they fill it like all the way up before they freeze it. So I'm just like, this seems terrifying.
Yeah.
Like if you're in there and you're like, I guess I'm drowning, and then they freeze you.
Yeah, they don't sedate them at all. So
no,
like,
he's awake and he's thrashing about.
Don't we have an amendment about cruel and unusual punishment?
But this, they're like, nah, it's totally cool. We'll just drown him a little bit. Freeze it. That'll be fine. It's like, oh, so you're freezing people when they're terrified.
Yeah. Well, the other thing, too, it's like, I mean, I just love the technology in this because it is so far ahead of what was even remotely possible in 1992. Because it's basically like there's like a little tiny glowing blue pellet
that
they drop in and then just freezes everything
instantaneously. And they're like, let's pump everything into cryogenic, like, research.
Right.
And so that got all of the money. And so it's like, we don't have a National Guard to take care of these gangs. All we got is this one guy. Oh, he blew up a bus. Okay, well, I guess we have to freeze him.
And then 40, almost 40 years have passed.
To the distant future of 2032. Right now, we are closer to 2032 than we are to 1996.
Right.
So think about that. We are past the halfway point to the Demolition Man future. In that time span, everything about civilization in Los Angeles changes.
And that's one thing that's also not made clear in the movie. Is this just the world of San Angeles that they have created for the movie, which apparently is San Diego, Santa Barbara,
and Los Angeles.
And Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And is life just this way here, or is it totally different in the rest of the country? Because they do mention federal laws and President Schwarzenegger's presidential library and stuff like that.
Arnold Schwarzenegger's presidential library, which is, again, this movie was filmed before he ever became a politician, so, like, that's kind of, like, a funny thing.
Weirdly prophetic.
Yeah, right? They don't allow swearing. There's no red meat. There's no physical contact, really, of any kind. So, like, sex between, like, consenting adults is completely forbidden. It's all done in
vitro. Like, in test tubes, yeah.
Yeah, it's all done in test tubes. Can you imagine if you came in from Cleveland and you're like, I'm going to visit San Angeles, and all of a sudden they're just like, no, you and your wife can't have sex. You can't do these things when you're here. And like, they give you a ticket every time you say like shit. That's insane to me. So it has to be like the society of the United States has broken down to the point that there's like city states.
Yeah, I mean, that's the only thing I can think of, but they're still loosely affiliated into the United States where there is a president. I mean, maybe things happen because I think they reference that there is a large earthquake that happens.
Sure.
And that's
the great earthquake happened.
Right.
In like early 2000s in the film, not in real life. Nobody panic. So in the film, there's this giant earthquake that happened in like 2006. It sank a part of Los Angeles underground. But like, okay, so then they rebuild it and they you know, like this. And then Nigel Hawthorne's character, Dr. Cocteau, you know, he's the like savior that comes in after the destruction. That doesn't change the fact that like there are federal laws that would supersede the stuff that's going on here if the United States as we know it was still operating the same way.
I really don't see any of that coming true.
No, I think that this movie takes place too close to present day. We'll talk about, like, they had to re-edit and they cut out a bunch of stuff. One of the things that they cut out is that John Spartan meets up with his daughter. I think that's why the movie takes place in 2032, is so that his daughter was there and she was an adult. And of course, it's Hollywood, so you have to hire an attractive woman. And so I think that's why they made it 2032 and not something like 78 or something.
Yeah.
You know, because like if it was significantly into the future, I feel like it'd be a lot easier to understand why this stuff is happening.
Yeah.
Like the only way that I could probably justify it in the world of the movie is that Cocteau was like, I'm going to rebuild this city and I'm going to make it my way. I'm saying you can't eat hamburgers anymore. You can't swear at anybody anymore. You know, sex is right out. Like, he's just this, like, really weird, super repressed dude. And he's like, but I'm the only one that has the money to rebuild this city. So either you guys hang out, you know, in your rubble, or you do it my way and everybody listens to jingles on the radio from now on. And then only, like, Dennis Leary was just like, nah, fuck you guys. I'm going to go live in the sewers.
Yeah. So we keep going and it's 2032, Simon Phoenix is up for parole.
Right.
And this is my thing, though. Even with all of the manslaughter counts that John Spartan is convicted of, how the fuck does Simon Phoenix come up for parole before John Spartan? Well, I mean, and we'll find out why.
We find out why because the reveal of who the secret bad guy is actually plays a big part in explaining why this stuff is happening. For one thing, Simon Phoenix should have just been executed. Back in 1996, they were obviously still executing prisoners because, you know, everything is on fire.
Yeah.
It's just like they're not that advanced. They're like, I don't know about capital punishment. But yeah, so he's up for parole and he escapes.
Because he somehow knows like the access codes to get out of his restraints. And he like straight up murders a bunch of guards and the warden.
Who was the warden when
Sloane
got frozen? Because again, not that much time has passed.
Right. And I mean, and it's some pretty gruesome stuff because like to get out, there's like an optical retinal scan and he like uses a pencil or something, a pen. Yeah, that's what it is. Yeah, it's a pen. And he just basically pops the guy's eyeball out.
He takes it out really cleanly though. Yeah. Like, I understand, whatever, movie magic. But like, you know, the eye is like completely intact. It's like perfectly sitting on top of the pen. I'm just like, he did a really good job with it.
Yeah.
The guy, the warden then dies horribly from his injuries. But still, like, yeah, that's pretty good.
I mean, he's an artist.
Yeah.
He is an artist of crime. So all these murders, because in this future, everybody's got an implant, basically, that connects them and their life signs and everything.
To the computer.
Central computer network. The San Angeles Police Department gets alerts that crimes are being committed.
Specifically, a code 187, which nobody knows what that is.
Yep.
Because apparently murder hasn't happened there for like 20 years.
Code 187, the murder death kill.
Yes. And and of course, Rob Schneider, Bob Gunton, the owl, and the grown-up adult version of the helicopter pilot, they're all shocked and astounded and disgusted by this. It's like, oh my God, a 187 here in San Angeles. It's like, and again, it hasn't happened in 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, so they all see this. The one person, though, who is mildly excited by this whole situation is Sandra Bullock.
Lenita Huxley, who's a character in Brave New World, and then she's also named after the author of Brave New World.
Aldous Huxley. Yep.
So Lenita Huxley is like obsessed with the 20th century.
Yep.
So she has a Lethal Weapon poster in her office.
See, and that's my other headcanon thing, is that in this universe, it's still a shared universe, though, because that poster is because there was a documentary film about Riggs and Murtaugh called Lethal Weapon.
Lethal
and there were three of them.
Lethal Weapon was a biopic in this film universe. So she has all this stuff.
Well, and basically there's a conversation with Benjamin Bratt, who's a fellow police officer.
And a huge stick in the mud.
Yeah, exactly. Works with her. I mean, he basically talks about how everything in her office is contraband.
Mm.
She's allowed to have it because technically she's confiscated it.
Right.
So she's keeping it off the streets and away from the public, but it's really that she likes it. And so she's like,
so she just has it.
Basically breaking the law, kind of, but
everything in it is contraband. It's not like she just has, like, dildos everywhere.
Yeah.
No, it's, like, a poster for Lethal Weapon. She has, like, a jar with the snakes in them. You know, like, the joke snakes that pop out. It's, if all that stuff is illegal, it's just, like, why even, what are you even doing, society, like, in this weird St. Angeles society? Like, nobody can have anything. But especially, this scene is really funny because, you know, you establish their partner relationship of Benjamin Bratt, who's like follows orders and he's the like goody goody or whatever. And Sandra Bullock is the loose cannon, but like loose cannon in the weird, like future way of being a loose cannon, which is just that, oh, I like collecting stuff from the 20th century. So finally they're able to track down Simon Phoenix. And so they have like a squadron of cops that are going to, you know, converge on him and they're going to talk him down. I think this is one of my favorite scenes in the movie. In fact, I think it might be my actual favorite scene in the movie. Because Phoenix is just like out and about and just Wesley Snipes is just having so much fun playing Simon Phoenix. And so just to see him walking around, just fucking with people for like no reason. Like he just takes like a dude's hat off and like shoves him and things like that. Like there's all this stuff.
And it's funny though, because I mean, it's rare. I feel like it's rare since this movie that I've seen a movie where Wesley Snipes actually seems like he's having fun.
It's true.
Because, I mean, I want to say this has to be one of my first, like, exposures to him as an actor.
I really like Wesley Snipes. I always have, mostly because of this film. And again, I agree, it's probably the first time that I saw him in anything. And he is just having a blast as Simon Phoenix. And it carries over. It makes the character so much more fun. He's this awful, vicious sociopath. But it's just like, you really like him because he's just really charismatic about it. So the cops show up and, of course, wildly ineffectual. And also, though, he's using the computer and he's just like, oh, it's like I'm possessed. And so he's accessing all these different files and he's looking all this up and he doesn't know what he's doing. But he's, you know, able to access and find everything that he's looking for. And it's all just in his head. And then the cops show up and all of a sudden Simon Phoenix is like super karate guy. And he's like able to beat people up and throw them like across the street. Like so something happened to Phoenix while he was sleeping. And now he's like a super soldier.
Well, and I also love this scene because I love how the cops, they've got like riot shields, which they probably have dug out of somewhere, but they've never used. And they've got their like little halo sticks or whatever they call them. I can't remember exactly what they call, but let knock people out. And the guy who's like trying to confront Simon Phoenix basically has a display computer, like the equivalent of the iPhone, that's telling him how to deal with a violent sociopath.
And they keep referring to him as Maniac, where it's just like, in a firm tone of voice, approach Maniac and say, lie down and put your hands up behind your head. But then, of course, the computer gives him the terrible advice of being like, and add the words, or else. And I guess that's like, it's like calling Marty McFly a chicken to Simon Phoenix, because he's just like, at first he's just kind of ignoring them or whatever, and then he's just like, oh, okay, well, I guess I'll have to super murder all of you.
Or else what?
He kills all the cops, he blows up their cars by putting their little halo thing in the fuel cells. Explodes the cars and stuff. Yeah, and then he escapes. And so, you know, very quickly they realize it's like, well, we're completely outmatched. What are we going to do? So they call up Nigel Hawthorne. Dr. Raymond Cocteau. Nigel Hawthorne, for those of you that don't know, is a very famous British stage actor.
Yep.
He originated the role in Madness of King George of playing King George III. That's the big thing that people know him from, because they did a film version. He played George in that. And it's funny because the only reason why Nigel Hawthorne agreed to do this film is because he was inexperienced in cinema. And so he wanted to show that he had screen presence to the producers that were doing the Madness of King George movie. The producers were like, well, Nigel Hawthorne is our first choice anyway. So like, okay.
But it's just hilarious that he did Demolition Man.
Yes.
Because you see this movie, and yes, it's a fun movie. It's a, you know, an action flick, but they definitely got somebody way above what they needed to get to play this role.
Honestly, yeah. You could have moved Bob Gunton over to play Dr. Raymond Cocteau.
Oh, that would actually be good, because I feel like he would have that kind of fit where he's very similar in a way to the warden from Shawshank Redemption.
Yes. They're very similar characters if you look at it, because they have this facade of being these righteous men that believe in, you know, that believe in a higher power, that believe in justice and things like that. But underneath it all, no, they're not. They're just as crooked as everybody else that they pretend that they're better than. You know, the warden is stealing money and funneling it all, like, and embezzling. And Dr. Raymond Cocteau, of course,
we will get to that.
We'll get to his problems. But yeah, they're very similar characters in that idea.
So anyway, Dr. Cocteau, after they talk to him, it's decided that the best course of action now is, because the police of this era have zero understanding and capability to deal with this type of violence.
Yes.
They're like, well, we gotta find someone from the past who does. And, oh, wait, who was the one guy who was able to stop Simon Phoenix?
Yep.
John Spartan.
And this is what grown-up Zachary Lamb suggests. Yeah. Because Sandra Bullock is like, oh, well, Zachary, how did you guys catch him? And he says, he names all these things off, where it's just like, oh, statewide manhunts, checkpoints, you know, bolos. None of them worked. In the end, it was just one man. You know, it seems like you're glossing over the fact that, like, a lot of people died bringing him in. But, like, ignoring that, it's like, you know, a heads up, unless Zachary was like, John Spartan didn't do it. And he's like, you know, whatever, is like a conspiracy theorist about it. I feel like as a cop, though, you should say, like, oh, by the way, like a busload of people died bringing in Simon Phoenix with John Spartan. Because maybe they'd think twice about unthawing him.
Well, and I also, like, in my mind, it also goes to a very interesting place of what would they do if they decided not to defreeze John Spartan?
I don't.
Would Simon Phoenix destroy this entire, like, civilization, basically, because no one would know what to do?
You know, the funny thing is, and I only, like, because eventually you find out why Simon Phoenix was dethawed, and that was so that he could kill Dennis Leary. One person. And we'll get to the reason why later. But if they didn't defrost John Spartan and say they just kind of let Simon Phoenix go, I think a lot less damage would have been done to their civilization. Like, if Simon Phoenix is able to just go and kill Dennis Leary and that's it, and he didn't have John Spartan coming after him, he didn't have all these things, I feel like a lot less people would have died. Like, it's one of those situations where it's like, well, maybe it's for the best if you just let him get it. Of course, A, you can't put Simon Phoenix back in his box once that happens. So, of course, then you've just got him running around as a maniac. And then B, even so, Dennis Leary is not only an innocent man, but he is right. He is the only one that's actually speaking sense in this world. And so in a lot of ways, Dennis Leary should be the good guy out of the whole thing. Like, even more so than John Spartan.
Yeah.
John Spartan and Dennis Leary are both the good guys of this movie.
Right. Oh, for sure.
I think.
But anyway, so Simon Phoenix escapes, has decimated the police that were trying to get him, and they've defrosted John Spartan.
Yep.
And they take him to the police headquarters after they've thawed him out, and he is just cannot believe what the world has become.
This is the best fish out of water story, I think, especially in an action movie. You know, like, it's a very popular and kind of, it's a very fun thing to play around with. The first Thor movie, for example. And I think this one does it best because Sylvester Stallone has this amazing ability to really sell how bizarre situations are. Mm-hmm. And yet he's still able to have, like, a really good, like, levity about it. Sylvester Stallone is the best at those, like, one-liners that, like, kind of talk about the situation.
One thing I, on the rewatch that I had forgotten, that I really had an appreciation for, was Sylvester Stallone's sense of humor and his ability in this movie. And I'm of course, some of this is definitely the writing. But he obviously went along with it, being the star, that he is willing to do a lot of self-deprecation in this movie, which that's a big thing for me. I really appreciate actors, comedians who have that ability to look at themselves and play scenes in a sense that they're the butt of the joke sometimes, or that they're the one who is totally doing something wrong. And I've always thought Stallone is a good actor. But this movie really was like one of those where I'm like, oh, yeah, no, he's actually really funny. And I like that he's willing to poke fun at himself and allow his character to be that fish out of water.
Right.
And not take himself too seriously, because he totally does not take himself too seriously.
Yeah. And Spartan is a great like point of entrance character in this movie because, well, for one thing, again, you know, like these things are crazy. They don't have toilet paper. They have three seashells. And his response to that is great, you know, because he finds out that when he swears, like, are you shitting me? It spits out a little, you know.
Yeah, there's all little machines everywhere that basically spit out a ticket. Yeah, like you get a speeding ticket. Yeah.
But they're paper tickets, which is the important thing. He finds out they don't have toilet paper. They just have seashells. And everybody like, laughs. And they're like, ah, he doesn't know how to use the three seashells. Yep. Which they never explain it.
No, that's why, as we mentioned, the subtitle of this movie should be The Mystery of the Three Seashells.
Apparently, Stallone gave an interview afterwards, and he said that his concept of it was that you take two of the seashells, and you, like, pinch and, like, pull waste out, and then you use the third one to, like, scrape the remainder. I refuse to believe that that's how they work, because that sounds fucking horrible.
Yeah, I'm like, if that's the if it's the choice between doing that and never taking a shit again,
yeah,
I'm just gonna hold it, man. I don't know.
How do you wash like it's this? Is it the same three seashells? How do you wash them? When I was a little kid, the way that I envisioned it is that underneath the three seashells was like bidets. One is soap, one is water, and then one dries it. That's what I thought, is that they were seashells, but they weren't actual seashells. The seashells just covered up, you know, the butt stuff. That's the way that I envisioned it.
All right. Okay. Interesting, because my theory of the three seashells was always, a little similar maybe, but mine was that these were, because like when you find shells on the ocean, there's a lot of times, especially if they're still very close to the water, they still have the thing in them that lives in the shell.
Mm-hmm.
So in my mind, it's these like genetically engineered mollusk invertebrate type things that live in the seashell. And you hold it up to your butt and like one goes in and like scours all the waste out. And then one goes in and like washes. And then the last one like does like a disinfectant or like deodorant type thing, and then that you move on, and it's like they're these like actual organisms inside the seashells.
Yeah, I hope no matter how bad civilization gets, we don't get to a point where we're like, okay, I got it. Let's take a seashell and let's scrape it on our butthole to clean it out, and then we'll just leave it on a shelf for the next person to scrape their butthole. That's what I hope. I hope no matter what happens, we're drawing the line here. We're still using paper. This brings up a big point that I want to talk about. Everyone in the future are dicks to Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah.
And it's not even for like a good reason. I guess the warden from Shawshank, Bob Gunn, I don't know what his character's name is. The owl from Daredevil.
Right.
The owl is like the only one that where it kind of makes sense about why he's a dick to Sylvester Stallone, because he's like, oh, he thinks he's barbaric. Nobody really is angry at Sylvester Stallone or are mean to him because he got 30 people killed.
Well, yeah, I mean, and it's very much that the only reason they treat Sylvester Stallone the way they do is because he's from a different time, and therefore he's kind of like a savage and a barbarian to them. And for all the supposed enlightenment of this culture and like no swearing and everything, they are so, so dismissive and so like, in a way, insensitive to the fact that this man is now in an entirely different culture and things have changed completely.
Here's the thing. So out of the, let's say, six main cops, right? With, if you count Rob Schneider, Sandra Bullock, Benjamin Bratt, the owl, Zachary Lamb, and then the big fat guy that's there.
Right, yeah.
At least two of those, maybe the big fat guy, were all alive and old enough to remember the way things were before the big earthquake happened.
Yeah.
Bob Gunton is not a young man, okay? Yeah. He wasn't a young man when he was the warden in Shawshank or this. Like, so he if you, his character would have been like 20, maybe.
Yeah.
When Spartan was frozen. Maybe he doesn't necessarily know John Spartan's name exactly, unless he was like really big into the news, but sure. Doesn't change the fact that he was alive then and he knew what the world was like. This would be like, if you and I are like 20 years from now, if somebody wakes up and they were from like 1993 or something, mm-hmm. and we like laughed at them and were just really like mean and derisive to them because they wanted to wear like acid wash jeans, you know, and they were like, well, it's like, well, I got to find out what happened with the Jurassic Park movies. And then we were just huge dicks to them for just for that. And it isn't about his methods, which is what it should be. It should right. be about his methods. It should be about the people that he's hurt. But instead it's, oh, you're a caveman. You're this relic that we unthawed so that we can use you.
Yeah.
That's insane to me. Like, that's why I think it should be set.
Well, which leads into, like, basically the next main sequence of the movie
right.
is where they start talking about the cops are asking John Smart, and they're like, well, what do we do? And we, like, we did all these, the computer will do all these projections, and that's how we'll find Simon Phoenix. And he's like, yeah, you're not going to find him like that, because the most important thing is he's going to go for a gun, because he's a criminal from the 1990s. He's going to want a gun. And they're, again, like, Bob Gunton is totally dismissive, and he's like, that shows what you know, you Neanderthal. There aren't any guns. Man, if he wanted to find a gun, he'd have to go to a museum.
Which I'm like, yeah, of course that's where he's gonna go. Like, are you crazy?
And then, of course, Sylvester Stallone is like, well, we should go to the museum.
Yep.
And the next scene is basically Wesley Snipes going in walking into the museum, into the, was it the Hall of Armory? Or
the Hall of Violence.
The Hall of Violence.
The Hall of Violence.
That's right.
Which is a great, great name for something. Yeah. Like, if I were to write, Justice League, you know, I would have, you know, whatever, the Injustice Gang, instead of, like, hanging out in the swamp, I'd have them build their own Hall of Violence.
Yeah.
And, like, that's where they hang out.
Right. And so he goes in there, and there's all this stuff. There's, like, relics. There's swords and knives, but there's also
cannons.
All sorts of cannon. That's right. And he eventually, you know, breaks through the glass. It's like super hard plexiglass.
He throws a dude through the glass.
Yeah.
Which is the best. That's the best part, because the guy's like, oh, what's your boggle? And I guess that's something else that sets Simon Phoenix off. And then just grabs the dude and throws him. How much do you weigh? And then the guy is actually going to answer him.
Yeah.
Because I'm just like, everybody in the future are just fucking idiots, apparently. Oh, this guy's kicking this glass, and now he's wondering how much I weigh. I better tell him what I actually weigh.
Right. And this is my other thing, though, is for a culture that doesn't use guns anymore, I can see having them in a museum.
Sure.
But the other thing that they have, apparently, is massive amounts of ammunition kept in the museum with the guns. And I'm like, why would you ever keep ammunition? It's like one thing to say, hey, this is a gun. This was a tool that was used to kill people back in history. We're also going to keep this massive stock of bullets and shells just in case. I guess.
If you go to museums now, you'll see, even if they have a cannon, for example, they'll probably have, like, some cannonballs, because you want to, like, look at them. That's fine. What they don't have is they don't have all the gunpowder,
right.
the things that you need to fire the cannon.
Right.
This place is like, okay, let's put all these guns that all work, by the way. They don't have the firing pins removed or anything like that. These are actual working guns, and all the ammunition that you need for them, let's store that all together. That'll be fine. They lock the exhibit down, and how Simon Phoenix gets out is that he fires a fucking cannon through the wall. So it's like, let's say Simon Phoenix never escaped, never goes there, okay? This place still has all of these explosives in the museum,
right.
in a place that is prone to gigantic earthquakes. Like, this is such a poorly thought out museum that I'm like, I'm glad Simon Phoenix destroyed it. And it's funny because San Angeles is a combination of Los Angeles, Santa Barbara, and San Diego. The film is entirely filmed in San Diego.
Yeah.
So, like, this museum is a museum in San Diego. All they ever do is drive around the San Diego part. And I'm just like, and so, like, even the Los Angeles scene in the beginning of the film was filmed in San Diego.
Yeah.
So it's funny to me that it's like, oh, it's this giant metropolitan. And it's like, no, it's not. It's really, this is just this one beach town.
Well, and one of the great things, I've been to San Diego Comic-Con several times, and there's a part, I remember we were watching it, I was like, they were driving through, supposed to be like some sort of futuristic tunnel area, and I'm like, yeah, that's the convention center where San Diego Comic-Con is. I recognize it, like, exactly.
They didn't even, like, try and disguise it.
Yeah.
It was fine after the earthquake, so that's at least good.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, at least Comic-Con survived.
Yep.
Because, I mean, actually, you got to think, because of their obsession with pop culture, on the way to the museum, because, of course, you know, like we said, John Spartan figures out, hey, that's where he's going to go.
Yep.
So Sandra Bullock, Benjamin Bratt, and
John Spartan.
And John Spartan, they head off to the museum. And while they're in the car, they play the radio.
Yes.
And basically, the only radio station that exists,
that we ever hear, at least, I mean,
right. Is all commercials, like radio commercials. Like,
and they refer to it as the oldies station.
The oldies station, yeah.
So it's like the oldies station. It's all the commercials and like jingles and stuff.
Right, like Oscar Mayer. Like, I wish I were an Oscar Mayer wiener.
Armor Hot Dogs.
Oh, yeah, that one.
When they go to Taco Bell, the guy is playing the piano and he's playing the Jolly Green Giant.
Yep. So they go to the museum. There's a big shootout and a fight.
The fight actually between John Spartan and Simon Phoenix is awesome. As soon as Phoenix is able to extricate himself from the Hall of Violence, Spartan is able to like get in there. He's able to get some guns and then they have a big shootout in a like a museum recreation of a 1990s street. Which is actually kind of a really cool, like, at first I was like, oh, this is just kind of stupid, because it's like, we can see them, whatever, fight in the, you know, it looks just like the fight scene from the beginning of the movie.
Right.
But, however, looking at it now, I was just thinking about this when we watched the second time, it's actually really interesting framing for that scene, because here you have two people that are essentially relics of their time in this future. And they're fighting in a fake recreation of their time. It's almost like it's like a zoo scene, you know? Because when you have like pandas at like the Brookfield Zoo, they're in this like faked recreation of what the jungle is like in Asia, that where they would be in their natural habitat. So it's almost like Spartan and Phoenix are animals in a fake habitat in this fight scene. And I think that's a really cool way of doing it, and that actually makes it very interesting.
Because they're both relics. They're both like men out of time at this point. Yeah. Phoenix escapes.
Phoenix is able to get away, and as he's escaping, he runs into Dr. Raymond Cocteau,
along with his like assistant, Bob? Associate Bob.
That's right, Associate Bob,
played by Glenn Shaddix.
Father from Beetlejuice.
He's the interior designer.
He's the interior designer from The father from Beetlejuice is the pedophile guy from Ferris Bueller's Day Off. That's right.
Exactly. Jeffrey Jones.
Ooh, is a bad man.
Yes.
So he runs into Cocteau, and this is where all of a sudden, Cocteau has his heel turn.
Yep.
And it's revealed that he's the one that programmed Simon Phoenix to escape and to go and kill Dennis Leary.
Yeah, because basically what happens is Phoenix, who has a gun, says, hey, I don't, you know, who's this stupid old guy? I'm just going to kill him. What the hell? Mm-hmm. It'll be fun. But he can't. He can't pull the trigger.
He misses the first time, and he says, he's like, oh, I missed. It's like, oh, that's weird. And then he goes, gets right up in his face, and he can't pull the trigger. So, there's programming that's preventing Simon Phoenix from killing Dr. Cocteau, which is the only smart thing that Cocteau does in his plan.
Pretty much.
Because the rest of Cocteau's plan is awful. It's a stupid, stupid plan executed by this guy that apparently has this utopian vision, but he hates Dennis Leary so much that he jeopardizes the lives of everyone in his city.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah, so because basically Cocteau, after the kind of showdown where Cocteau's like, don't you have something you should be doing?
Yep.
And Simon Phoenix has these visions of Edgar Friendly, which is Dennis Leary's character. And
Mr. Edgar Friendly.
Yeah, he is basically the leader of, they call him the Scraps.
Yeah,
I think. Yeah,
they live underground, and they rob the food trucks, and they like kind of scrounge and try and live as best they can because they don't want to live under Cocteau's utopian plan.
Right, because they still want to eat meat and swear and have sex.
Yes. If you've ever seen a Dennis Leary stand-up special, Dennis Leary is playing himself in this film, in this like utopian society. He, in fact, even gets a Dennis Leary rant about doing a ton of weird things because this is America. And he talks about smoking Cuban cigars while like naked and covered in like honey or whatever.
Yeah.
It's like in Lethal Weapon 4, because we keep talking about Lethal Weapon movies.
Right. Because they exist in the same universe.
They exist in the same universe. It's like in the Lethal Weapon 4 biopic when Chris Rock's character all of a sudden just goes into a Chris Rock monologue, even though he's playing just like a regular, like button down cop. And all of a sudden he's like doing the whole like Chris Rock stand up. And I'm just like, oh, okay. So you're just going to do your stand up bit now. That's fine.
Right. Exactly. Phoenix runs off. And then this is John Spartan's also first encounter with Dr. Cocteau.
And Dr. Cocteau is so happy with Spartan saving his life, or he's acting happy because Spartan saved his life, that he invites him out to dinner that night at Taco Bell. And John Spartan, of course, has like the normal reaction when someone's like, thank you for saving my life, I'm going to take you to Taco Bell, which is to be a little confused. I wouldn't. If I like save someone from like a burning building, they were like, oh my God, let me take you to Taco Bell, I'd be like, oh fuck yeah, let's get quesalupas. But that's because I'm a simple man and I have simple desires.
And they go to Taco Bell, and it's super fancy. All the food is, like, artfully presented with drizzles of sauce and everything on it.
The way I think about it, so they say, you know, after the franchise wars,
I love that.
Taco Bell is the only restaurant that exists. So every restaurant is Taco Bell. So I imagine it's like almost like Famous Ray's Pizza, right, in New York, where you have, like, original Famous Ray's. Original Ray's and stuff like that.
Right.
So all of the restaurants are Taco Bell, but not all of the Taco Bells are kind of the same. So you have like a casual Taco Bell, and this is like the fancy Taco Bell.
And I think there are still the actual fast food Taco Bells as well for people who are on the go and need to go through a drive-thru.
Yeah. But also, like, so this is something I was thinking about this just right now. All the food is very tiny and things like that, but they don't allow red meat. They don't allow things that are bad for you, so like cholesterol and things like that. So like coffee is outlawed. So a lot of the food probably is all this like super organic, like vegan friendly stuff.
Tofu,
Oh man, I don't know if I can live with Taco Bell.
Tofu quesalupa?
I don't know if I could handle tofu Taco Bell. Like I don't want to think about like a grilled stuffed tofu Rita. Like I'm just like, no, I think that's where I'm like, ugh, I draw the line there.
But so anyway, they go to dinner there, and while they're at dinner, there is
the scraps
attack.
And they're robbing the food truck for Taco Bell. So Stallone goes out. He's able to knock a tent down on top of them after like beating up some guys, and then they escape. And he's like, Stallone's like, oh, they're just stealing food, and so he feels upset and conflicted about it. Meanwhile, Sandra Bullock is like so wet at watching John Spartan beat up people. She is like super into it and like down a bone right after this.
Yeah. So they go back to their apartment, which I believe just from plot convenience also ends up being in the same building.
Yeah, it's in this. Well, because she got him an apartment.
That's right.
When they defrosted him. Yes. Whatever you want to call it.
But de-thawing him would be freezing him again, I guess. I know. I've made that mistake, too. So.
Yeah, you're like, that would be like when they got him out of the hockey puck, they put him in the fridge so that he slowly melts.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know. The point is that he's no longer frozen.
Right, exactly.
He no longer is letting it go. No. So she gets him the apartment in her building, and his is just like bare and just completely empty. Whereas hers has like a jukebox and all these 50s stuff and like more contraband that she stole from work or whatever.
Yep.
And she's like, yeah, let's have sex.
And he's like, whoa, wait, what? Now? And she's like, yeah, I like you, and it would be fun, so let's do it.
It's bone o'clock.
And she's like, I'll go put on something more comfortable, and you just make yourself comfortable. And he's like, okay. And and apparently all the apartments have basically, like, a sunken living room.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, I'm like, okay, so we're going back to the 70s here.
He sits down and prepares himself, and then Sandra Bullock comes back in.
Yep, she comes back in with these two headsets, and she's like, here, put this on. And he's kind of like, all right, this is the future. Maybe this will enhance the experience, you know, whatever. And so he puts it on, and they start getting these, like, flashes. He starts getting these flashes of Sandra Bullock, and, like, in the throes of passion. Honestly, the way it's filmed, it looks really painful.
It looks incredibly painful. And, like, he, like, keeps, like, blinking, and, like, it flashes in and out with this, like, loud static noise. And, again, they're sitting, like, 6 feet away from each
right.
other. And trying to do this, like, mental sex.
Yeah. Oh, another great thing I also think is hilarious about this part is you get to see Stallone making what I think is a vague approximation of his O-face.
Yeah, you do get to see Stallone's O-face.
And I'm like, oh, man, I hope that's not what it looks like. And did you, like, look in a mirror at some point?
Or
did you think that that's what you look like, so that's what you're going to do?
His poor wife.
Yeah, right?
In a lot of ways, Sylvester Stallone's poor wife. No, no, no. I actually really like Sylvester Stallone, so I'm not willing to say bad things about him. Because he's great. I love Sylvester Stallone. Anyway, so Sylvester Stallone is, John Smartin is just like, no, I can't do this mental sex anymore. This is stupid. And so he's just like, I thought we'd do it the old fashioned way. You know, the naked mambo, the hunka chunka.
Yeah.
What is this? Like, there's no way anybody wrote those lines. They're just like, Sylvester Stallone was just like, I'm just going to ad lib a bunch of names for sex that I think about. Yeah, the hunka chunka.
I know.
Got
hunka?
It. Perfect.
Chunka,
which if he's like yeah, hunka chunka, that is a perfect description of having sex with me. I don't ever want to see Sylvester Stallone having sex with anybody. Like, if that's where he's just like, oh yeah, yeah, hunka chunka,
that's the sound. Totally. That's the sound. Oh, that happens.
Good god. So she refuses his efforts.
Yeah,
for the hunka chunka,
the swapping of bodily fluids.
Yep.
That idea for her is just so beyond the pale.
Cannot handle it. And so then right after that, we get Simon Phoenix coming back to see Dr. Cocteau. And we made a couple references to this earlier, but I'm going to talk about this. So Warner Brothers disliked the first cut of the movie.
Yeah.
So they brought in editor Stuart Baird to do some re-editing. And not just reshoots, like just editing of the film. But I bring this up because right before the Taco Bell scene, we see Simon Phoenix go down into the sewers, and he's dressed normally.
Yeah, it's basically after he confronts Cocteau.
Yeah. And then after the sex scene, Simon Phoenix is in Cocteau's office, and he's wearing this, like, Road Warriors garb, you know, stuff. Like, so he looks like an 80s, you know, WWF wrestler. And he's just like, oh, you know, what's John Spartan doing here? And he's like, I'm going to need some guys, you know, I'm going to need some goons to take out Edgar Friendly.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that there's something that happened that got edited out of the film, but it's this, like, weird thing where it's just like,
right.
Simon Phoenix goes down in the sewers to kill Edgar Friendly, decides he's like, I'm going to need some guys, but I better take these clothes with me.
Right.
And just, like, went shopping, I guess, in the sewer.
Yeah, I guess my personal theory for that scene, or that whole disconnect,
mm-hmm.
is that he goes and tries to kill Edgar Friendly. But because, as we see a little bit later, the scraps are definitely armed.
Yep.
They have guns. They're willing to use violence.
They're like they're like the Raiders in Fallout.
Yeah,
because they have, like, pipe pistols and things like that.
Sure. And so I think he maybe goes and tries to kill him, but fails.
Mm.
And he maybe kills a few scraps, mm-hmm. like trying to get to Edgar Friendly, and maybe steals some of their armor and their garb. And then he realizes, all right, I can't do this on my own. I've got to get some help, because these people actually are willing to fight, as opposed to all these pansies up on the surface. And so I think and that's my personal thing about what happens.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
So, and then we get that next point where you know, he basically convinces Cocteau to give him access to
he gives him a list, defrost
all these other criminals.
Yeah, and former governors of Minnesota.
Yes.
Or future governors of Minnesota.
At this point,
Yeah. So I'm going to actually just jump ahead to when we see the gang that's been defrosted for Simon Phoenix. So they're hanging out at like a pool table, which I can only assume is in the sewers because they're also drinking beer. And it's Jesse Ventura and then like two or three other like goons. And they look like they're just goons.
Yeah.
And then a bunch of women. So my question is this. Did they go into the sewers where they're like, this is where Edgar Friendly is, but we're going to drink his beer, we're going to play pool, and we're going to get, like, pick women up from the scraps or whatever to hang out and, like, be, like, all sexy? Or did they de-thaw some honeys to, like, bring with them? Like, they're just like, we need to get some women with us.
Right.
Don't want to turn this...
Also criminals who have been frozen in the cryo prison. Yeah.
He had, like, two lists where he's just like, governors that I want as my thugs... And then also a list that's just like, we don't want to turn this into a sausage fest. So let's get like a couple women that are arrested for like murder or whatever. Bring them along too.
Right.
That's what I'm wondering. Because we never see them. We never see the ladies later in the shootouts and stuff.
Right. Well, and so, I mean, there's that scene that happens. And then so the next thing we get is because after the abortive sex scene happens, Sandra Bullock throws out John Spartan, basically, from her apartment.
Oh, yeah,
she's like, get out of here right now, you and your actual having physical sex. You're such a caveman.
I don't want to ever have hunka-chunka with you.
Yeah. No one wants to have hunka-chunka. I mean, because it sounds like a Ben and Jerry's flavor.
Oh, God, like the worst Ben and Jerry's flavor. It's just got like, I don't even want to think about what's in it.
Yeah, right, exactly. This is not an ice cream that you want.
Nobody wants that. he goes home and we get 80s, 90s action movie staple of boobs.
Yep. That one random scene where we're going to have boobs just because we can have boobs in an R-rated movie.
And she's doing like it's like a video call. This woman's like calling up her boyfriend and she's like naked and stuff. And I'm just like, this entire future is like, makes no sense. Cause it's like, why would you be naked for that video call if you're never going to actually have sex?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like, this is all just one giant Cocteau tease is all it is. That's what the future is.
Oh, for shame.
I love it.
Well, and then he also like he goes to his apartment and first of all, he trips because the lights are like voice activated and he doesn't think to like say lights on when he comes in and he trips into the sunken living room and he's like, why is there a sunken living room everywhere?
I would do that all the time. Like even if I lived there for like my entire life, I would fall into that thing constantly.
I guess it makes more sense because they don't like have alcohol. And people don't get drunk anymore.
Sure.
So whatever. But I'm just trying to think, like, if I had a sunken living room, I know there are multiple nights when I come home on the weekends from being at a party or at a bar with friends that I would probably break my ankle.
Even just, like, out late.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't drink at all last night. I went to bed at, like, 1. I was still just, like, so tired that I, like, almost, like, ran into, like, the wall instead of going through the doorway. I mean, like, that stuff happens.
Right.
So, like, I would kill myself multiple times with those sunken limit, like,
you got a coffee table. It's, like, probably, like, your head would just go right into that thing.
Oh, God, forget about it. And if you had, like, a glass coffee table, like, you're just asking for, like, to commit suicide.
Well, one of the fun things we find at this point, too, is that he finds in a drawer, like, a ball of yarn.
Oh, yeah.
And knitting needles.
I'm gonna bring the knitting thing. So that's his reprogramming.
His rehabilitation when he was under in the cryo freeze.
He got knitting skills, and Simon Phoenix got like jujitsu, and now he knows.
Well,
that's the
big plot point coming.
But so he sits down with one singular ball of yarn, and he knits Lenina Huxley a sweater overnight. Absolutely not. As my mother knits all the time, like constantly. She's knitting right now as we record this, and she's also knitting right now as she listens to it. I guarantee you it. So she constantly knits. So she also makes like sweaters and things like that.
Right.
It would have taken him at least 6 balls of yarn to make that sweater. And that's being generous if he's like able to like make it like big knitting or whatever. It also would have taken him weeks. days. He can't overnight. I don't care how programmed you are. You're not going to knit an entire sweater overnight. Like, that's insane. Like, that's so much.
And that's the thing is, like, that's the big, one of the big plot points where they start to figure out what's going on, because the next day, Spartan realizes, he's like, okay, why did I knit a sweater? And she tells him, oh, this is your rehabilitation. And he's like, okay, wait a second.
Let's look.
I remember Simon Phoenix. He was a bad motherfucker back in the day.
He wasn't a judo master.
Yeah, he was not a martial arts super soldier.
Yep.
And so they go to the file and look, and all of these things that were programmed into Simon Phoenix while he was in cryo-freeze, obviously by Dr. Cocteau, and to make him the perfect killing machine.
And that's when they figure out it must be to go and kill Edgar Friendly. So it's like, okay, well, that's what's next. Here's the thing about Cocteau's plan. Because I said I was going to talk about this. Cocteau's plan makes zero fucking sense.
Yeah.
Because Edgar Friendly is one dude. Yes, he has a lot of scraps. He has a lot of people with him. However, still one person. Why would you take a guy who's already like a vicious, violent sociopath and give him this giant laundry list of things? He doesn't have to know like kung fu and judo and stuff in order to kill Edgar Friendly.
Yeah.
Like, he's not going to challenge him to like a blood sport competition and like rip his throat out at the end.
Right.
Like, so you're taking a guy who's already violent and dangerous, and you're making him even more dangerous, like to a level that you do not need him to be, to a point where... Great. I'm glad that Cocteau is immune, or Phoenix can't kill Cocteau because of the programming. Terrific. However, you didn't do that for all the other innocent people in your city. And you also probably didn't include a failsafe to like make him fall asleep or whatever. Like, if you would have built in safeties into Simon Phoenix's brain, where then you can turn him off when you're done using him, that's fine. If Simon Phoenix kills Edgar Friendly, what is Cocteau's next step? It's like in the Simpsons episode when all the frogs are running around and they're like, oh, well, we'll get snakes to kill the frogs. It's like, well, but then you have all these snakes everywhere. It's like, oh, well, that's okay, because we'll bring hawks in to kill the snakes. Well, now you've got all these hawks. So, like, killing Edgar Friendly by introducing this insane maniac is just changing a guy who's doing the right thing, and maybe you don't agree with him, okay, and you're exchanging that for a fucking maniac that goes around blowing up cop cars and killing innocent people. That is absolutely bonkers to me.
Well, and the other thing, too, is that Edgar Friendly, the scraps, they're not really that much of a threat.
No.
They occasionally steal food trucks.
Yeah.
You know, and it...
It's an annoyance, and you're getting a mass murderer to deal with it.
Right. That's the biggest thing, is that it's just like, it's not very, to me, it's very clear in the movie that the scraps are not a threat to Cocteau's utopia and that way of life.
Right. They just want to live their own lives in the sewer. Yeah. Also, it's been 20 years before anyone's committed murder. So no matter what the scraps are doing, they're not violent about it.
Yeah.
Nobody is dying. Until you defaw a maniac.
Right, exactly. Why would you do this?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like he's so... It just shows you that for all this utopian vision that Cocteau has created, he is still, at his core, he is not a good person. Mm-hmm. He is not a nice man. Because he sees this one person so, like, ideologically opposed to him that it frustrates him so much that he's willing to just be like, nope, I want to kill that guy.
What we were talking about before, where he's the warden from Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah.
Like, he's the characters are very similar, and it's true. For all we know, Edgar Friendly called Cocteau obtuse one time.
Yeah.
And that's like, it's like, oh, I got to kill this motherfucker.
Yeah. Right. So anyway, because they find out this information...
Then they go into the sewer.
Yeah, they go underground because they're like, wait a second.
They know it's Cocteau.
Yeah.
Because he says to Edgar Friendly when they meet up with him, he's like, I think Cocteau wants to kill you.
They go in underground, and this is where there's the great scene where Stallone, he smells meat.
Oh, yeah.
And
he's like, oh, I could go for a burger.
Street vendor selling burgers. And he's like, oh, this is great. And he gets a burger, and I think it's Benjamin Bratt, who's like, that's not
You don't see any cows.
Yeah,
well,
I
know.
I think
here.
He, like, Benjamin Bratt mentioned something, and then, like, Sandra Bullock is like, do you see any cows? And he's like, wait, well, what is it? And she's like, oh.
It's a rat.
It's rat. Yeah. And so the rat burger, he actually thinks is pretty good.
Yeah.
Because
he like,
hasn't had a burger
he's
in,
like,
you know, almost 40 years.
He, like, coughs, and he's like, it's not bad. And he eats the rest of it.
Yeah.
Like, that's the best part.
Well, and he gets it. He gets a cold beer, too,
yep.
Which to get washed that down.
Finally gets a beer. So then they're in the sewer,
yep.
And that's where they finally encounter Edgar Friendly. And that's where we get the big Dennis Leary doing his stand-up monologue routine thing, which is great because, I really like Dennis Leary. I like his stand-up a lot. Rescue Me is a great show. It was a great show. It's not airing anymore. So Dennis Leary's act is actually really good, and it really fits for Edgar Friendly. Because as I said before, Edgar Friendly is the good guy in this. He's absolutely right. You should be able to live and do what you want and things like that. I mean, he goes a little overboard with it because he's like, I'd rather live in the sewers where I can smoke cigars and, like, whatever than I would then live up in Cocteau's, like, world. And I'm like, I get that. You know, Edgar Friendly is a guy that you can really get behind. But then as they have this meeting and Sylvester Stallone basically tells him, like, I don't really care what you do. Go ahead and, like, you know, live down here. I don't give a shit. However, Simon Phoenix is out to kill you. And then that's when Simon Phoenix and Jesse the Body Ventura and the others show up and they're like, oh, well, let's just, and they just get into a gigantic firefight in the sewer. And this is apparently in this scene, Sylvester Stallone is protecting a woman in it. Like, he runs and, like, tackles and gets her out of the way. That's his daughter from the original cut of the movie.
Right.
So this is one of those things that kind of survived the editing of it, where it's like, if you're wondering, wait, why is Sylvester Stallone carrying this woman, like, out of there?
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things that happens. Apparently, they also cut out a big fight scene between Jesse Ventura and Sylvester Stallone.
Why? Why would you cut that scene out? That's like, I mean, for all I'm sure of the good that Stuart Baird did when he came in to edit this movie,
sure,
I do have to say, I think, dude, you made a mistake there, because
yeah.
I think we all would like to see that big old throwdown between Jesse Ventura and Sylvester Stallone.
Also, it's like, you know, in the theatrical cut of the film, Jesse Ventura is there for, like, two scenes.
Yeah.
He's there in the first scene when they're talking to him, and then later we see him when they're back at Cocteau's office.
Yep.
So it's like, if that's it, like, that's crazy. But, like, if there was actually a big fight scene between him and John Spartan, like, that would have been pretty cool to see. Yeah, so I'm bummed that got cut out, because I would actually really like to see that.
Big firefight showdown. But eventually, again, this is another point where things don't go his way, and Phoenix basically
just runs,
just punks out,
yeah.
You know, and he runs away, and he goes back to the surface, and they, while they're there, and, like, I think it's like right before Stallone gets the burger, they found a, like,
Camaro?
I can't remember exactly which car it is, but it's an old muscle car.
Yeah.
And he's even more impressed by Huxley a little bit, because she knows exactly what it is and the type of engine.
She loves muscle cars.
Yeah, and I mean, because she is such a big fan of pre-Cocteau civilization. And basically what they do, and this is a great thing, because when they need to get back to the surface, and they're like, we got to get after Simon Phoenix, they realize that this car is in an old elevator.
Yes.
And
why is the car in an elevator? I don't know.
Who knows?
Who cares?
It's like an old elevator. But how they get to the surface is the elevator busts through the floor of a building up on the surface world.
And it's like the ground floor of, like, a car dealership.
Yeah, it is a car dealership. But it's like it busts through, but there's nothing above it. And I mean, I guess, yes, there are elevators that do work. I think, like, I have one in the building I live in that they are hydraulic. They don't have, like, a winch and counterweight system. But I'm like, I don't think this is how elevators work, guys.
No, you still need an elevator shaft for hydraulic elevators. Otherwise, you would never be able to get it back down.
Right.
Like, you can't, like, it breaks through, and then, but it's like, but there's, like, a cage on top. You would not have been able to take that elevator back down if there wasn't a shaft around it.
Right. Yeah.
So the fact that it breaks through the floor is insane.
Yeah. When we rewatch it, I'm like, yeah, I really don't think that's how elevators work.
It's not how elevators work. I can guarantee you that. But then we get into a big car chase with Simon Phoenix and John Spartan. Spartan is eventually able to get onto, because Simon Phoenix stole their cop car.
He steals a police car, yeah.
So Spartan is able to jump onto the police car and, like, rip the door off and stuff, and he's fighting with Phoenix. And as they're fighting, Phoenix admits what we kind of all assumed is that the bus passengers were all dead already.
He'd already killed them.
He'd already killed them before John Spartan showed up
and
in
just,
the 90s.
Like, basically put them there to blow up the building and frame Spartan.
And I kind of wonder, like, how... What kind of forensic lab do they have in 1996 that you couldn't have figured that out?
Because, I mean, yeah.
Unless the fire and it was just down to their dental records, maybe?
Maybe, but I feel like we see them bring one of the bodies out.
And it's like a body still.
And it's like very visible, like not a horribly charred limb is like sticking out of the body bag.
Yeah, you can get time of death from that.
That's one thing, but I mean, and maybe I'm spoiled by watching a lot of Law and Order, which my wife and I like to do, and I mean, and I don't know if that's completely accurate, but from what I understand, any sort of trauma, like an explosive trauma to the body, like if it's a corpse already, you would be able to tell.
Oh, yeah,
that
yeah.
You would be like, oh, well, there's no bruising, or it's like there's no like evidence of this person bleeding because of these wounds from an explosion. So I'm pretty sure forensic scientists can say, oh, no, this person was already dead when they were in this explosion.
Yeah.
And so it's like, I know it's a contrivance for the movie, but especially in this era of so many criminal procedurals and things like CSI.
Yeah.
And Bones and all of the, and Castle and stuff like that, where it's like, no.
So yeah, it's just bad police work by the CSIs is why John Spartan gets frozen, basically. Yeah. So then Phoenix goes back to Cocteau's place and he's got his gang in tow. And so, you know, Dr. Raymond Cocteau's like, oh, well, you can't kill me and you're supposed to kill Edgar Friendly or whatever. And Phoenix is like, yeah, you're right. I guess I'll just have one of these other murderous thugs shoot you instead. And Gakuto's like, oh, I don't know why I didn't see this coming. So he gets murdered because it's like, again, Dr. Raymond Cocteau is able to do all these amazing things for civilization. Yet he's like a dumb, dumb person. And he just gets murdered by Jesse the Body Ventura. And they just chuck his body into like
the fire pit. And as often happens when you have underlings, Associate Bob is very much like, oh, no, I'm all on board for your now future dystopia that you wish to create, Simon Phoenix.
Yeah. Allow me to be of service to you just switch his sides immediately.
I'll manage all that. I'll do all your number crunching and all the accounts. I'll just take care of it.
Oh, cold-blooded Associate Bob. Yep. And Associate Bob, I think, gets away in the end. Like, yeah. I don't know if he gets... I mean, I don't think he dies.
Maybe he ends up getting punished.
No, he doesn't. Because he joins up with Dennis Leary.
Oh,
remember, Dennis Leary,
yeah,
like, makes fun of him for his robe and his clothes and stuff. So Associate Bob gets away scot-free.
He shifts allegiances twice.
Yeah.
Because he goes from Cocteau to Phoenix, and then at the very end, Phoenix to Friendly.
Right,
and he's
to
like,
Friendly.
I will, I'll help you run your now future dystopia.
And he just like gets made fun of by Dennis Leary. And I'm like, this guy, that motherfucker should be going to prison.
Yep.
But Associate Bob goes with Simon Phoenix and his gang to the cryo prison to unfreeze a bunch more like thugs and stuff. Except, well, there's a little mini shootout.
Yeah.
Spartan and Lenina Huxley are able to take out a couple of the goons at Cocteau's place.
Right.
And that's where Stallone's like, well, I'm going to have to do this. And so he knocks out Sandra Bullock and like leaves her there because she's a woman. She can't handle it.
Yeah, she can't fight because she's a lady. And that's like, you know, it's like we talked about a little with Top Gun. I'm kind of like, it's like for the most part of this movie, you know, she's pretty capable because she's shown as the one who knows how the future works.
Mm-hmm.
And she kind of will do some of the stuff with the computer when he's like trying to figure out patterns of where to look for Simon Phoenix or what's going on. But then when it gets to the point where it's like, uh-oh, there might be some more. This is going to, when the ultra violence is going to happen.
Yep.
Oh, nope. Zoop. oh, got to knock her out and make sure she stays safe. Because...
So the man can go in and do the violence.
Right.
For the most part, the Lenina Huxley, it, like you said, like she's very capable. It's a very good, you know, female lead. She does have the weird, like, Ziva tendencies from what is that, NCIS mm-hmm. show or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
My mom watches it.
Yeah.
She's very into it. But in that show, or, like, in the movie here, Huxley knows colloquialisms from the 90s.
Yes.
However, she says them wrong. So she's like, let's go lick this guy's ass. And so it's like, haha, it's hilarious. Yeah. But like, so that's her character.
And there's something, the one with, what does she say about blow him?
Let's go blow this guy.
Let's go blow this guy.
Away.
Blow this guy away.
And she just shrugs. Just like, you shot that. You're like, well, you didn't want to do the hunka chunka with Spartan.
Right.
So I doubt you want to blow Simon Phoenix.
Right. Exactly.
No, but so he knocks her out and he's like, I'm going to go and take care of this.
Yeah.
So, like, Simon Phoenix is unthawing people like Jeffrey Dahmer, and so Sloane's like, I can handle this with one gun by myself. And he just goes, and he, yep. like, you, it takes a maniac to catch a maniac, is what right. he says, as he puts his little beret on yep. to go in and, like, go and fight crime.
Big showdown, fight in the cryo facility. There's lots of, like, Simon Phoenix tries to refreeze Spartan.
Where did Simon Phoenix's goons go?
Yeah.
Because Simon Phoenix is by himself for the most part. Like, mm-hmm. he shoots the guys that work at the cryo prison, the, like, yeah. the actual, like, scientists and, right. and, like, warden and stuff. But, like, nobody else is there. Like, none of Simon Phoenix's goons are there. And I'm just like, what happened
yeah.
to them?
It's pretty vague on that. Because I think they were might have gotten to the point where they were just like, again, you know, the editing.
Right.
I mean, it makes you wonder if there was another big action sequence that if they were like, we got to cut this for time, guys.
Yeah, I mean.
This movie is too long.
It's possible. They're like, no one will care what happened to Simon Phoenix's goons. Well, I care, okay? But so they get, so John Spartan gets in there. He's like, okay, and he and Phoenix have actually a really cool fight where Simon Phoenix is using the claw thing that they use to pick up frozen mm-hmm. goons and stuff. He uses that to grab John Spartan. And again, we see the fact that no one can shoot at all because he's like firing wildly and like completely missing him, even though he's held in a, you know, basically a giant version of the claw game that you see at like Showbiz yeah. Pizza.
Well, he's also got, there's like a laser thing that they use to like, I think, cut.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Got prisoners out of some of the ice and, like, cut the ice chunks. So he's like, using that. So there's, like, lasers and all that. But it finally gets to the point where the he realizes that he's got the... there's one of the pellets they use to freeze people.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And John Spartan figures out that, oh, wait, maybe I can use this... Because he sees there's, I think it's like there's a bunch of water. That's
Everybody is like covered in, everything is covered in water right yeah. now for some reason.
Because, well, there's like steam and condensation from
yeah,
the ice.
Yeah, and the gun,
everything.
And like the guns going on and things like that. So like there's, you know, water is everywhere. And Simon Phoenix is getting ready to like stab him something. And so Spartan grabs that, smashes it on the ground and starts freezing everything.
And he grabs onto the arm,
the claw
that's still spinning around like a carousel ride.
Spinning around wildly. And he's able to, and he's just like, hey, heads up. And he kicks him in the head. And that brings me to the last thing that I really wanted to talk about, which is how much foreshadowing there is in this movie. And that is actually one of my favorite parts. Like, for an action film script, Demolition Man is actually really well written. In the opening scene, Simon Phoenix says, I'd lose my head if it wasn't attached. And Spartan says, I'll remember that. And then in the end scene, he kicks his head off. And it's just like one of those little things where I'm like, ah, that's great. Yeah. I enjoy it when they do like callbacks and stuff. Also in that scene, before Simon Phoenix sets the big fire that engulfs the building in the opening scene, he says, oh, is it cold in here? Or is it just me? And that's what Spartan says to Phoenix when he gets to the cryo prison.
Yeah.
I'm like, ah, I love that. I love the little like callbacks and stuff. It's the script of this is actually really good for, you know, for an action movie.
He defeats Simon Phoenix, which is great. And they come out and everybody's like seeing the cryo prison explode, basically.
Yeah.
Everything's ruined. And
Bob
Gunton.
Demolition Man.
Yeah, he is. He's got to demolish everything. And so Bob Gunton is just freaking out, the police captain, and he's like, what will we do now? What will happen?
Dr. Cocteau is dead.
Yeah, what will become of our society? Everything's gonna just be awful.
And Dennis Leary's like, oh, we're gonna get buck naked, we're gonna smoke cigars and shoot fireworks off. And so someone's like, no, stop it. You be less crazy, you guys get more crazy. And he's like, and work your way to the middle.
Right.
And so the idea is, like, the scraps and the everybody else are going to, like, become a unified society, a unified normal society where people can eat meat again and have
sex. And have sex. Yeah, exactly.
And then it ends with, Associate Bob turning face again and joining up with Edgar Friendly.
Right.
And then Sylvester Stallone and Sandra Bullock head off for a little hunka-chunka.
Yep.
At the end.
Because he does kiss her.
Yes. And she's like, oh, I like this.
This is what this is? All right, I could be on board with this.
And then he's like, just wait, there's more. And she's like, more? And then then implied hunka-chunka happens. Yep.
Oh, it's just such an awful term.
It's an awful term. So some final, like, fun facts about Demolition Man. Simon Phoenix's role was originally offered to Jackie Chan.
Right.
But Jackie Chan turned it down because he didn't want, like, Asian audiences to, you know, associate him as a villain.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reference to Jackie Chan in the film where Sandra Bullock is able to do, like, karate kicks and stuff. And he's like, and Spartan is like, well, where'd you learn how to fight like that? And she's like, oh, from watching Jackie Chan movies. So that's, like, a fun little thing.
I also like the fact that the original Lenina Huxley was Lori Petty.
Yes.
Who was actually cast.
And she filmed a couple.
And she filmed a bit, and they must have seen some dailies and just went,
nope.
She
got Eric Stoltz from Back to the Future in this movie. So, yeah.
But
which is crazy. So, like, the fact that Lori Petty would have been the love interest in Demolition Man and Point Break just, like, blows my mind.
Yeah.
So. Jack Black shows up in one scene as a member of Edgar Friendly's gang. Yeah, he's one of the scraps. And apparently, this is something else that I love. Nigel Hawthorne, it's said in the trivia thing, Nigel Hawthorne did not get along with Sylvester Stallone or Wesley Snipes. And so it's just funny to me because I'm like, those are the two they name. So in my mind, that means that he and Sandra Bullock were really good friends. But also that means that, like, Nigel Hawthorne and Dennis Leary were, like, pals. And, like, the idea of the two of them being pals, because they didn't explicitly say they didn't get along.
Right, yeah.
So I'm like, okay, that's it. Nigel Hawthorne and Dennis Leary were, like, buddies during the filming of Demolition Man.
Well, and also, but it kind of works, though. Because he's so contemptuous to both of them,
even to
Simon Phoenix, who he's hired,
he's
defrosted to do his dirty work. He's so full of contempt for him.
He's
and
a
John
huge
Spartan.
Asshole to both of them, but like especially to Simon Phoenix. I'm like, I do not blame Simon Phoenix for killing him. I'm like, yeah, that guy was a fucking dick to you.
Yeah, and so I guess the big question, and now that we're, you know, we've covered a lot of our talk about the movie, is, you know, how do you feel? Does it hold up for you?
I like this movie less as an adult than I did as a kid.
Okay.
As a kid, it's really easy to just kind of ignore all of the various problems with the thing. But as an adult, so in my comics and stuff, a lot of the things that I really like is world building.
Yeah.
I have a lot of background information on all of the comics that I do. I have a lot of background information on not just the characters, but the world they inhabit and things like that. I appreciate when you spend a lot of time developing the worlds. And I feel like that's a big problem in Demolition Man. I feel like the world itself is not very well thought out at times. That's not to say that the movie isn't good. As I said before, I feel like the dialogue and the script is really good. The performances are great. It's a very fun movie. I've seen this movie like 30, 40 times. Like, I've seen it a lot. And in fact, I own it on DVD and I still to this day will watch it when I feel like it. I just personally think that I liked it better as a kid and I just don't think it holds up as well.
Yeah, no, I think that's the big thing. And I think even when I first saw it, maybe, you know, being a little older, there was just, and I also am a big fan in fiction. I read a lot of the science fiction. One of the big draws for me, like, why I like A Song of Ice and Fire, aka Game of Thrones. There's a novel series called The Expanse that they made a television series out of. And both of those are very heavy on the world building.
Yeah.
And so I am very much also a fan of very well thought out and constructed worlds. And I think there are just a few missteps in this movie that they make. And one of them, like we've mentioned, the idea that it's such a short period of time is, I think that's a flaw. I feel like it should have been longer.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I feel like they kept it like that just so you could have the old version of Zachary Lamb.
Yes. As the
to tell everybody
pilot.
About John Spartan.
Right. Which the same thing could have been done by just Lenina Huxley being very well versed in the 20th century.
Right.
And again, like we said before, I feel like I feel like another reason why they did that was so that Sloane's daughter could be a thing. And instead, because they edited it all out, instead it's just like there's references to his daughter being alive,
right.
And then nothing ever happens.
Right. And I think it would have been even better and more interesting story to tell had it still have his daughter in it. But like you said, have it be an older actress.
Mm-hmm.
You know, have it be a woman who's in her 60s. And so it's much further in the future, and I think that's a more interesting dynamic to
play. Where she's like Cable to his Cyclops, where the child then is like 20, 30 years older than the father.
Right, and I think like that'd be a much more interesting story than having them be in this one, it was probably roughly the same age.
Or she was like a little younger than him.
Yeah.
No, she would have been, they were in the same age.
Same age or slightly older, maybe.
Yeah, depending on how old she was when he got frozen.
Right. But I mean, I like that idea of if she's a lot older.
Right.
And that plays up that interesting dynamic because, I missed basically your entire life. Because if they meet when they're roughly the same age or maybe she's slightly older or whatever, there's still a lot of her life left for him to reconnect with her and everything. But if she's in her 60s or 70s, that's big. And that's a big change. And I mean, maybe this isn't the movie to explore that kind of dynamic because it's still kind of lighthearted, fun action flick. But I think it would have made for a more interesting story.
That's true.
And again, like the little things we looked at where if you sit down and think about the movie, you're going like the museum where it's like, yeah, why would you keep ammunition and explosives? This just doesn't like actual live rounds and live explosives. This makes zero sense at all. No one would ever do this.
And that's the thing about Demolition Man is that like the more you think about it, like the less stuff makes sense.
Right.
You know, which is fine for an action movie because you know, as you're watching it, you're not really thinking about it. I still think in terms of like if you're looking at like the 90s action movies as like a thing, I still think Demolition Man is one of the best. I think it has issues and it has problems, and that's fine. They all do.
Yeah.
So I would highly recommend watching this movie if you haven't seen it. If you have seen it, go back and watch it again because it's awesome.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I think that's a very interesting point, too, is like for and I think I wonder if that's and it'll be interesting to see as we go along and rewatch some of these movies, because I am very interested to see because when we were talking about like Lethal Weapon and this movie being in the same universe.
Oh, yeah.
One thing, and you know, this could just be higher caliber of director and writer working on Lethal Weapon, but Lethal Weapon, it's an action flick, but the story in Lethal Weapon holds together
very well.
Very well.
Yeah.
You know, with the idea of the like Vietnam veterans who get involved with the drug trade while they're over there, and then when they come back to the States, they keep it going, and that's like a big heroin smuggling thing. But the plot of that movie, I don't feel like has as many, if any, because I really like Lethal Weapon, and that'll probably be one we talk about eventually, but that movie really holds together very well, and I wonder if we might find if there's a dichotomy between the 80s and the 90s action films that I wonder if that maybe the 80s hold together a little more plot-wise sometimes.
Well, but the other thing to think about, though, is that Lethal Weapon was done by Shane Black and Richard Donner.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas Demolition Man was done by Marco Brambilla.
Yeah.
What other films has he done?
Yeah.
I can't think of
it.
Because he's only done two, and his last one was Demolition Man.
Right.
So I don't know what he did before this movie. I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
So, like, that's, I think, is the big difference. But that said, there is a big, we'll definitely see, like, a big sea change that happens between action movies in the 80s and then action movies in the 90s. There's a very big shift somewhere along the way, and I think it's the development of special effects, particularly digital effects, but also movies like Jurassic Park and things like that, where then PG-13 becomes the big moneymaker.
Right.
So in the 80s, you're allowed to do different things because the big moneymaker was R-rated action films.
Yeah.
And then as you get into the 90s, more and more and more, you're courting the children audience. And so then from like, I think I'd say right before Jurassic Park, PG-13 becomes the big moneymaker, and that's what the big shift happens.
Yeah, and I think when you go for that younger audience, I mean, and not that this is necessarily right or the right thing to do, I think there's a sense among executives that you have to, in some way, also dumb down the plots for the younger people.
For the kids.
So it's not as complex, it's not as involved, and you don't have to pay as much attention. And so, yeah, I think that's a very interesting thing to look at with the way movies change from the 80s into the 90s, especially when it comes to action blockbusters.
Yeah, it'll be very cool to see kind of how that goes.
Great.
So, yeah, awesome.
Well, hopefully everyone enjoyed this, and we will see you next time on Cinemastalgia.
Yeah, have a good night, or whatever, day. Cinemastalgia is produced by Dave Kelch and Warwick Johnson. You can find us on iTunes and Blog Talk Radio. If you liked the episode, please subscribe, rate, and review.
Our theme was written and performed by Andy Berline and mixed and mastered by Peter Carparelli. For more info about the show, please visit cinemastalgia.com.